Good morning. Today we're taking a look back at the year gone by with a collection of some of the conversations that resonated with us. We'll hear Beth Ann's discussion with Joshua Benton of the Nieman Journalism Lab about the effect of digital media on journalism. We'll look at the future of the world's fisheries, remember Hawaii Congressman Mark Takai, reprise a visit from Americana musicians Anders Osborne and Luther Dickinson, visit Hawaii's first lightsaber academy, and talk with author Simon Winchester about his latest book, The Pacific. It's Monday, December 26th. We'll have those conversations for you right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Beth Ann is off today. And we're doing something a little different this morning, a review of some of the conversations Beth Ann and I have had during the past year. To begin, in recent years, traditional journalism has been largely overtaken by digital media, and the number of journalists employed by newsrooms has dramatically fallen. That digital migration has allowed journalists to write from anywhere and be read everywhere. As with any sea change, though, there are advantages and drawbacks. Last month, Beth Ann talked with Joshua Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University, about the new face of today's journalism.
It is certainly true that one of the significant outcomes of a shift from print media and broadcast media to digital media is that both print and broadcast media are based around location, right? Newspapers get printed, and as far as the trucks can drive to deliver them in the morning, that's how far they care about from a position of editorial coverage. Same is true for broadcast outlets. When you shift to digital media, you also shift to national media, and the result is that in the United States, media has become far less concentrated on the middle of the country or outposts, and much more concentrated in New York and Washington. And I think that does, in the long run, have a deleterious effect on the kind of news that we get.
I mean, over the last 15, 20 years, we've watched bureaus close in many news outlets. And as you say, local media giving way to this, you know, cluster of media in certain places. We seem to think that we were watching this phenomenon. Did we just simply choose not to pay attention?
Well, I think that the decline of the traditional media and newspapers has been covered in a number of ways over the years.
But not the fact that this was beginning to really cluster in ways and that all people were not being represented by the diversity that online journalism promised.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, there was a story that was told in the 90s and the early 2000s that said that once digital media, we make the transition to digital, then there's no reason to have physical newsrooms. People can be distributed across America, across anywhere. People can live and provide that extra geographical diversity. But I mean, let's be honest, living in New York and D.C. is quite expensive. It's a lot cheaper to live in many other places around the country. But what we have seen is this intense concentration. I mean, my own career, my first job at newspapers was at the Toledo Blade in Toledo, Ohio. Mm. And I worked at the Dallas Morning News before coming to Harvard, which is part of the coastal elite, I suppose. But, you get a different perspective when you're actually there and you're covering local issues for local media. And increasingly, as we get more of our news through social platforms, forms through the news feed on Facebook or your stream on Twitter, it's a much more nationalized market.
The flip side of that was also part of the promise that we would have more citizen journalists, that we would have people who had those feet on the ground telling the real story, and that would localize it in a way that in some cases even media couldn't do. Is that really just a myth?
Well, I think there's actually a lot of truth to that. I mean, think about all the breaking news events that we hear about first through Twitter, through people who are at the scene of an event who catch the photo of the plane going into the Hudson, or who are able to report live from Black Lives Matter protests or from, you know, anti-Trump protests. I mean, I think that's a very real phenomenon. What I think was a bit short-sighted about the way that some people viewed this, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, was the idea that these people were going to view themselves as citizen journalists and that they were going to have something approaching the same sorts of standards and procedures and processes that traditional journalists have had. And what we found, I think, quite clearly is that most people don't feel the need to think about things that they see in the same way that a journalist might. And that's totally appropriate. There's nothing wrong with that. But that does mean that we end up sort of having a cacophony of information, a lot of it very good, very interesting information. But we've kind of lost some of the interpretation tier and the analysis tier that traditional media used to provide.
Right. The idea that first reports are simply that, first reports, and good to be able to see them, but doesn't give you the same kind of in-depth reporting with through the same kind of lens that journalists have traditionally used. And that, you know, one doesn't have to be the substitute for the other, but that both can coexist. So where do we go from this point, Josh? I mean, now that we are becoming more aware of some of the downsides to online journalism.
I mean, really, in a lot of cases, for local news, it's an uphill battle. I'm just going to be honest with you. I mean, newspapers have shrunk a lot, as you said earlier, but they also still have a long way to go down. I think if we're having this conversation in 2 years or 5 years, or particularly whenever the next recession arrives, whenever that happens, we're already seeing really significant declines. Most of the publicly traded newspaper chains saw advertising declines of between 12 and 19% at this past quarter, and that seems to be accelerating rather than slowing down. Now, there are a variety of folks who are trying to move into that void. You have public radio stations who in many markets are really investing in providing local coverage. You have nonprofit news outlets. You have some for-profit local news sites that are doing a good job, but they're very unevenly distributed. I mean, basically every newspaper, every city of any size in the United States had a newspaper, and I think that's increasingly not going to be the case. And even the places that do have them are going to have shrunken newspapers that are kind of shadows of what they used to be.
I hear you say that there are some opportunities in smaller locations, smaller cities, for the kind of, you know, public radio journalism or nonprofit journalism or even a small for-profit, if that could be managed, that there might be a way of moving back to that. Is that what you see?
There will be in certain markets. The real difficulty is that newspapers were, in the old days, were both mission-driven institutions that wanted to try and do good civically-minded journalism, but they're also incredibly profitable. Newspapers made a lot of money in the second half of the 20th century. Digital media is increasingly dominated by two companies, Facebook and Google. Together, they earn around 85 to 90% of all new digital advertising revenue every year. The enormous power that they have gained in driving people's attention means that between the two of them, send about 80% of the traffic to a lot of news sites. And they are essentially hoovering up all the money in this ecosystem. And that means that increasingly the successful local news outlets are not going to be ones that are driven by people who want to make 30% profits or 20% profits or 10% profits. It's going to be people who see it as a civic mission. In some cases, that's going to be a local philanthropist who decides to buy the local newspaper and fund it accordingly. In some cases, it's going to be corporations and institutions who want to donate to their public radio station. In some cases, it's going to be something new. But the business case for local news keeps getting worse day after day.
Right, and we've watched this happen where it was, you know, people would start experiments and hope to monetize it, only that didn't happen and they had to find another avenue to be able to create an income stream. But given the fact that, you know, Facebook is now having fingers pointed at it for, you know, false news reports, is this undercutting a sense of perhaps, you know, trustworthiness in what Facebook hoped to do as a provider of news for people who were tuned into Facebook more than anything else?
I think that the fake news phenomenon on Facebook has led to a decrease in trust of the media in quotation marks. That's a very broad term that means a lot of things, more so than it's meant a distrust in Facebook, because a lot of the people who are consuming fake news, you know, saying that, you know, Barack Obama finally admits he was born in Kenya, or Donald Trump died of a heart attack last night, or the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump. These are all fake stories that have circulated in the last few days on Facebook. The people who read them are often people who have a deep distrust already of the, you know, the mainstream media, as they would describe it. And they view Facebook as a place where they can get the real truth. In this case, the real truth is lies, but it hasn't really resounded to hurt the trust of traditional media in this particular case. There's lots of other things that are causing that to be the case, but increasingly I think that the great news companies of this country are going to have to, you know, stake an independent claim and figure out how to gain support for their business models and for their journalism through something other than Facebook traffic.
Joshua Benton is director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. Before starting the lab in 2008, he was a newspaper reporter, most recently with the Dallas Morning News. He was an early builder of websites and blogs starting in the 1990s.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
America hasn't always celebrated its roots music, but there's a new appreciation these days of music that grew right out of the earth, the so-called Americana movement. Luther Dickinson and Anders Osborne, two younger artists who have spent their lives at the junction of country music and the blues, are giving the people's music new life. We spoke to them in June. Luther, both of you kind of grew up with what I would call a pretty enviable exposure to the music of America, yeah?
It's so true. You know, growing up in New Orleans, growing up in Memphis, Tennessee, in North Mississippi, it was just amazing, you know, especially Memphis. My father was a musician. He grew up in Memphis in the 50s and the 60s, the 70s, and that's everything from rock and roll to R&B Stax to the blues revival of Furry Lewis and Bucca White. And then for us to know R.L. Burnside and Uther Turner and Junior Kimbrough, go down to the Juke Joint in Mississippi, modern-day rural Mississippi country blues. It was fascinating. I mean, I knew I wanted to play guitar, but just the local community and the culture that I found myself living in once I got my driver's license changed my life.
Well, your people like the Uther Turner whom you describe, the people you describe are storytellers as well as musicians, right?
Indeed, yeah, they were. And it was funny, back home, everybody played different versions of the same songs.
Yeah, right.
You know, and Uther was 94 when he passed, a first-generation Mississippi blues man and a self-sufficient farmer, a wonderful person. And R.L. Burnside as well, he was a genius with words. You know, they spoke in blues poetry. But Burnside, man, he was a master at jokes, stories, poems, lyrics, of course, and very, very, very intelligent, wise men.
As a lot of those, I've had some time around Mississippi, Fred McDowell back in the early 70s.
Wow.
He was the same way, and he could kill you with that guitar, but also he'd keep those stories going all
really?
Night long. Yeah,
very charming. Know.
Yeah, raconteur for days.
He was the king. And this is not Mississippi Delta blues. We live in the hill country.
Yeah.
And that's just east of the, you know, you go up the bluff, you know, the Mississippi River, then the Delta on either side, and you move up into the hills, which goes all the way up to Appalachia, you know. It's hilly all the way.
Yeah.
And that's the type of the music that we listen to, Fred McDowell, Uther Turner.
But it changes when you get from the Delta to the hills. It changes a lot, doesn't it?
Definitely, yeah, yeah. Well, the Delta blues, I mean, really, that was a thing of the past in a lot of ways. It was, you know, the heyday was the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, mm-hmm. and there's still electric Delta blues. But in the 90s, the hill country blues was amazing. There is a new movement of Mississippi blues right now, and it's young urban blues, mm-hmm. which is very exciting.
Well, it just what it shows is that the music is not a museum relic, right?
Exactly, yeah. The Delta borders on that, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not comfortable with all of Mississippi, to be frank. Mm-hmm. You know, the Delta is still handicapped with racism. And they capitalize on the exploitation of the history, of the culture. But it's still an awful, awful place.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear a little candor about it because it tends to be hopelessly romanticized, either hopelessly criticized or hopelessly romanticized.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's a magical place because, you know, the people and the art, but it's still hard times.
Well, Luther, one of the signature sounds is that slide guitar, and you just happen to have one on your fingers. Exactly. Which is a sound produced by dragging a, what is that, a glass slide?
Yeah,
you got?
Glass or metal.
And what that gives you is a lot of freedom to mess with the pitch, right?
That's right. All the blue notes. I love it.
The notes in between the notes.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. The ones that Thelonious Monk were reaching for.
Yeah, Monk would hit two adjoining keys to try to get that sound.
That's
right.
Right. It's a magical thing. But, you know, it's all trying to recreate the human voice, you know?
Exactly.
Be it clarinet or trombone or a slide guitar.
Yeah.
Or Jimi Hendrix.
Who was solidly in the blues tradition.
Right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's not given enough credit for that, I don't
think. Oh, yeah, he was the best.
Well, listen, you and Anders are both here with your guitars in hand, so let's not have them go to waste. Right?
All right. We'll play a little blues in a C.
Okay, fair enough.
Let it roll. Let it roll, good Lordy, let it roll. Let it roll, good Lordy, let it roll. There's a wheel in the sky, keep a turning by and by. Let it roll, good Lordy, let it roll. I heard the lonesome whistle blowing, let it roll. Heard a long summer whistle blowing, and let it roll. As you board the final ride, we bid you goodbye. The glow of train pulling out of the depot. So let it roll, let it roll, let it roll, good Lordy, let it roll. Smiling down from the sky, from the home, oh, high.
You know, if you couldn't play the notes in between the notes, you wouldn't have a song with that song. Am I right?
That's a good point.
You did one slide, I think, from the third fret to the octave, just playing every note in between. I should say every note and every non-note in between.
That's right.
Up from the bottom.
There's people who study all the microtones. They say there's like 98 in between the octaves.
Yeah.
But that's way too much for me to think about.
Yeah. Well, it, as long as you end up at a note, you're okay, right? That's basically how it
or
works.
Or is it saying it's to be close enough?
Hey, they say that at a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. We've been listening to the Hawaiian music every night at dinner. You know, we've staying at this wonderful place out by the beach. And,
yeah.
Oh, wonderful guitar playing here.
There's a great guitar tradition here. Yeah, there really is. Thanks to Anders and Luther. Thanks both of you for coming in. It's great to meet you and great to hear you.
Bless you. Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure. You can learn more about Luther Dickinson and Anders Osborne on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Thank you.
If I die down in New Orleans, would you throw me a big parade?
Dr. Sylvia Earle is a key player in the movement that has brought ocean conservation to where it is today. She's the author of more than 200 publications and has led more than 100 expeditions with over 7,000 hours underwater. Beth Ann talked with her in September to ask her where the marine conservation effort today is headed.
I say in my lifetime I've witnessed a parallel course. One, we've learned more about the nature, not just of the ocean, but of who we are, where we've come from, maybe even where we might go in the future and how we could get to a better place than we are. At the same time, we've lost more. We have the power to change not just the land, not just the nature of the skies above, but the ocean. The ocean. We've changed the chemistry of the ocean because of what we've been putting into the sea. The excess carbon dioxide is acidifying the ocean. We've warmed the ocean as well as the rest of the planet, but the ocean has been the great stabilizer, taking up much of the heat generated by the warming that has as its core the burning of fossil fuels, new in mostly the last half century, that we have increased our impact.
We here in Hawaii, fish is a very important part of the diet for many people. But for you, you don't eat fish. And you've said that if we only knew, we probably wouldn't eat fish either. What is it about fish that we don't know in the way that many people simply regard them as a commodity?
Well, humankind has a long history of consuming wildlife. I mean, 10,000 years ago, primarily consumed wild creatures for sustenance. But go back 10,000 years ago, our numbers were a few million. When I came on the planet in the 1930s, the numbers were about 2 billion. And now we're edging up toward quadrupling that number in a matter of decades. So 7 billion, and some say that maybe by the middle of this century it could be as many as 10 billion. The planet doesn't get any larger. For us to survive and thrive, we have become farmers. We've cultivated most of what we now consume, but we still have this deeply embedded habit of taking wildlife. Most people tend not to think of what lives in the ocean as wildlife, bushmeat, if you will, but every wild fish is like a wild bird. Even when my parents were kids, taking wildlife from the skies, wild birds, was a common thing. And some are still, you know, ducks and geese, a few are taken by hunters, but not by the truckload anymore. We've come to see wildlife on the land with new eyes. Yes, most things are edible, but we choose to keep them alive for other reasons. We need to respect life in the sea for more than just commodities.
You've made the point over time that fishing has changed, that, you know, for indigenous cultures that live and need to have
By the sea,
and they have to have sustenance that comes from the sea,
right,
is sort of, you know, one thing, but the way fishing has been industrialized, particularly over the last, you know, 60, 70 years, has also dramatically changed the way the ocean behaves. We've watched Westpac become a member of the IUCN. Do you find a strange irony in that?
Well, it's well to have representation of the many voices that have interest in the nature of the ocean. What's curious is that we're making decisions about life in the ocean, and we talk about having the stakeholders, the constituents, but most of those who are being affected, that would be life in the sea itself, they may be on the table as lunch and dinner or breakfast, but they're not at the table. And neither are those in the future who will inherit the consequences of the decisions we make now. If we keep taking on the same level that we are now, the trend from the 1950s to the present time is one of consistent, steady, and now precipitous decline. We talk about sustainable fishing, but where's the evidence? When I was the chief scientist at NOAA, a piece of paper came across my desk saying that bluefin tuna in the Atlantic had declined by 90% in 20 years. And I attended a fisheries council meeting, and I said, what are we trying to do? Exterminate them? Because if so, we're doing a great job. We only have 10% left to go. That's when they started calling me the Sturgeon General, because I had the audacity to speak up for the fish. Well, now it's not 10% anymore. It's less than that. And they aren't exterminated because there have been efforts to try to have some kind of constraint on how many tons we take. Again, it takes a lot more small tuna than big tuna to make a ton. And we're talking lives here. The big old fish, the ones that we have extracted, basically the distillation of what has taken all preceding history to get into an ocean that was working in our favor. And it's taken us a few decades to unravel these tightly wound food webs, these nutrient cycles, the chemistry of the ocean, by extracting on the order of 100 million tons. Tons, we're talking now, how many lives of the shrimp and the crabs and the krill and the oysters and clams and tunas, and in some countries still take whales. And it's just amazing. We have the capacity, literally, to clear-cut the ocean. So this is not about sustaining needs. This is about money. It's about fostering a commercial extraction of wild creatures on an industrial scale. And it does not show respect for the ocean, let alone up for ourselves as sentient creatures who should look at it and say, this is not working. Fish have values that transcend just something to eat that is largely, for most people, really think about world. It's a choice. It's not a need. For those for whom it is sustenance, for whom it is a need, well, we need to preserve through having large protected areas, because even with relatively simple methods, we can diminish wildlife. But it's understanding what the limits are and working within that framework.
Dr. Sylvia Earle is explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, founder of the Sylvia Earle Alliance, Mission Blue, and founder of Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, Incorporated. She was named Time Magazine's first hero for the planet and a living legend by the Library of Congress. She's the subject of a Netflix documentary, Mission Blue. One of the most entertaining stories of the past year for us was an October visit from Keith Milet of the newly established Hawaii Lightsaber Academy, who brought his gizmos with their unique sound effects along with him. It takes a lot of skill to wield one of these things, doesn't it?
It sure does, yes. It's easy to be dangerous swinging it around wildly, but one, it doesn't look as fantastic, and it's not as safe. So yeah. It does take quite a bit of skill.
Well, I should probably start by asking you, what is this thing?
Okay, so Hawaii Saber Academy. I teach parkour with Precision Parkour and Keiki Parkour. And a year ago, with Force Awakens coming out, I decided to kind of on a lark start this. And I thought, oh, what a great way to get some attention and maybe have some fun. I had no idea that it would turn into what it did. It was very successful from the beginning, got lots of attention. And then I just really discovered that I really enjoy learning these different sword arts and these weapon arts. I treat it as if it's a martial art, but we take it with a grain of salt. We're not a real martial art. We are swinging around lightsabers.
When you talk about sword arts, you're talking about centuries and centuries of acquired skill from cultures all over the world. A lot of them a little different from each other, right?
Oh, yes, very much, because I mean, the original Star Wars movies, it was very kendo-based, and I try to make it clear that we're not teaching kendo, we're not teaching fencing. I respect those ancient traditions and the knowledge they have, and I wouldn't want to say that we're doing one of those because, again, it's lightsabers. However, we are inspired by those, and I try to learn from European, Asian, even Eskrima. Like, there's many different weapon arts that we can kind of be inspired from and adapt.
When you say kendo-based, I associate kendo with kind of this two-handed sword well forward from you.
Mm-hmm.
But what's a capsule description of kendo when you say kendo-based?
So the two-handed, the first style of saber combat is called shicho, and it's primarily a two-handed weapon system. And it's also European, has like long swords and
sure.
broad swords are two-handed. One thing that's interesting is we don't have to put that much – it's kind of ironic, but we don't have to put too much force into our blows because we treat it as a lightsaber. So a grazing touch is going to cut through like butter,
mm-hmm.
right? So we don't have to put that follow through and force. And what the effect of that is that I can tap my opponent's shoulder safely and not cause them any bodily harm.
And in a competition, you've then scored a point, right?
Yes. In our system, we call it shim and sai. A shim is a grazing blow, and that's elbow to hand or knee to foot. And that doesn't count as a point. There is a slight advantage in our system because if you score a shim on the forearm or leg, you continue to have the right of way, so you can attack again. And it gives you a slight advantage. A sai is a killing blow, basically, and that's your shoulders or your hips. Also, gently on the top of the head with a certain technique. And those would be a point.
So it takes a really disciplined approach is what it sounds like.
It does. We've had students training for a year in this first style, and there's seven styles. So, I mean, you could be training for a decade and learning the different styles.
Well, listen, Keith, I want to fire up the gizmo before we run out of time because it has a presence all its own.
Okay, yeah, so it's all about the lightsaber. So here we go. This is a sparring quality lightsaber. It's got motion detector and a soundboard, so I'm contacting my hand right now for the blow.
As you make contact, let me hear that sound.
And then as I sway it to and fro, it can make the that noise. Clashing, as if two sabers were clashing, makes that. And then also turning it off, this sounds pretty cool as well. And we're actually having a tournament. It's our first annual tournament. My students have achieved a level of technique, and it's kind of a tournament and a test for them as well. And it's meant to be all in fun. But we're going to do that in December, and that's pretty exciting as well.
Yeah, I'm assuming you've created all kinds of criteria for how to score points, who wins.
Yes. There's a fencing club here in Honolulu, Sal Honolulu, and luckily I've made contact with them, and they have also been giving me some knowledge on the long history of fencing rules.
But fencing, it involves thrusting, which saber work does not do.
In our system, we'll never thrust because it can cause harm.
Sure.
These blades are soft and they're round-tipped, but the tip is the most dangerous part, and we don't want to hurt each other. With Hawaii Saber Academy, we have a guiding philosophy. It's called RAISE: respect, aloha, integrity, safety, and etiquette. And what that means is the respect and aloha is you're helping each other. We want it to be not really so competitive. We want it to be fun. And the integrity is hopefully you call your own shots. You get hit, you call it. We're trying. It's all in good fun. Safety is really important. So the thrusts are not allowed. And the students, once they get it, they understand and they target. They do the right techniques. And that's really important. And then etiquette, we have like formal bows. And we try to circle around if there's a duel or a spar. We have everybody else circling around. And
it's great exercise, right?
Oh, yeah.
Once you start schlepping one of these things around for a couple minutes, you get your upper body knows it.
Your upper
quickly,
body, your
it?
Core, your legs. I'm not exaggerating. We had class last night, and there were some students about half hour in that were laying on the ground covered in sweat. not exaggerating on that.
Keith, it's thanks so much for bringing your saber in. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you, Chris. May the force be with you.
Well, let's hope so. Keith Milet is the founder of the newly established Hawaii Lightsaber Academy.
You still have to find what's beautiful, what the reason is that you're still here. You have to find reasons every single day.
We recall the story of Jenny Stepanek and her remarkable young son, Maddie, the child poet in a wheelchair. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
Season's greetings and Happy New Year! This is Erica Schwarzkopf, head of the Female Comics of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies, as well as what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we are welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers look out for Venus and Mars in our evening skies. Venus will be in the west just after sunset, and Mars will be towards the southwest. Now, the moon this week will be a mere crescent.
And I understand that you have more information on an important discovery of water and ice somewhere in the solar system?
Absolutely. We are returning to the asteroid belt and to Ceres, that magnificent dwarf planet that was recently the target of NASA's Dawn spacecraft. Scientists have been analyzing the flood of data that has been downloaded to Earth from Dawn, and within this data is a treasure trove of revelations regarding water on Ceres. The data shows that there is water on Ceres, not just some, but a lot. In fact, it's a case of water everywhere.
And does this mean it's good, clean, crystal clear drinking water? So if you and I were thirsty and we just happened to stop there, we'd be able to be in good shape?
Unfortunately, it's not quite so clean. It's a little bit dirty.
What's in it, Christopher?
Well, most of this water is frozen solid and mixed up a little bit with some of the rock on the surface of Ceres. Not exactly nice, clean drinking water.
Right.
What's really cool about this data is not only that it shows definitively that water ice can exist in the asteroid belt, but it also hints that there may be liquid water beneath the surface. Dawn was able to sniff out this water using an awesome instrument called GRAND. This stands for the Gamma Ray and Neutron Detector. This wicked piece of kit was able to sniff out hydrogen in Ceres' crust.
And so it was the hydrogen that led him to the water?
It was. As you know, water is made up of hydrogen and oxygen. That's why it has the chemical symbol H2O. It was this hydrogen that led Dawn to massive amounts of water ice.
So if you get some kind of strainer to get the rock out of the water, is it then drinkable?
Absolutely. You're probably looking at some of the finest quality water in the solar system.
We just got to get that transportation mechanism there.
It's a long way to go for a cool glass of water.
Christopher Phillips and another fun Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. So far in my adventure to find what it is that makes people want to be generous, one theme continues to resurface. Generosity runs in families. Science has shown that there's a gene mutation that causes altruism, and it can be passed from generation to generation. Here's an example of it. Joy Miura Coerte says, "Giving back to the community was emphasized in our upbringing." Take a look at the funds she and her family have started, and you'll quickly see that this is an understatement. There's the Tad and Margaret Miura Fund, the Deja Vu Surf Hawaii Scholarship, and the Rise Up Scholarship, which is for students of divorced parents. Rise Up was initiated by Joy's sister Sarah while she was working two jobs and attending grad school. She waited tables part-time to save enough money to start her scholarship. And, as do many other generous people, Joy says they receive much more back than they give. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
It's Festivus for the rest of us. This is Dave Ciano. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Author Simon Winchester sees the Pacific as a place where cultures clash, a place where there's challenge in the air as East collides with West. For him, as he crafted his latest book, Pacific, the challenge was giving shape to an admittedly vast subject. He met it by choosing stories from atom bomb tests and the Pueblo incident to the voyages of the Hokulea, stories that combine to tell a greater story, one where by the end he finds signs of hope. Our conversation back in March began with reflections on how little people remember about the nuclear testing conducted in Pacific Islands during the 1950s.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, of course, not terribly far from where you are in Hawaii, just a couple of thousand miles to your west. Even there, I found relatively little was known about what happened in mainly in Bikini and Inuitok. But they were extraordinary events, and the way that the American military, and I'm not being critical of the Americans because I'm an American myself now and have been now for the past 4 years, but how they sold it to the Bikinians, essentially quoting the Bible to these newly converted Christian Bikinians and saying, if you look at Exodus 13, verse 21, where it talks about the Israelites being led out of slavery in Egypt behind a pillar of fire. God. Well, we Americans, they said to the Bikinians, we Americans can create a pillar of fire and a pillar of smoke with this new technology that we've created. So will you regard that as a symbol of doing the Lord's work? And will you kindly, therefore, leave Bikini for a while we create more of these pillars of fire and smoke? And the Bikinians said, innocently enough, yes, we will. I mean, it strikes me as a terribly cynical use of religion to persuade people to leave their homes and then completely destroy their island and transport these people to a little refugee island called Kili in the south of the Marshall Islands, where there's no atoll, there are no coconut trees, there's no port. They have to have their food airdropped to them, and it's much of it, the food is, of course, Coca-Cola and Spam, and so people are getting diabetes and all sorts of health problems, and now their island is being flooded because of rising sea levels. It's a very unhappy story, and Bikini and the Marshall Islands generally.
And in many ways, a kind of a last gasp of the colonial attitudes of, you know, the European asserting his rights over non-white peoples of the world, not in taking their land, but taking the entire cultural identity and using their location for our own purposes, yeah?
Well, and that strikes me, I mean, that's one of the, it wasn't intentional at the start, but many of the chapters talk about that kind of thing, about, you know, the European colonists essentially began pulling out of the Pacific, I suppose, after Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam in the 1950s, and then the British left Hong Kong, and of course the Japanese were forced to leave after the World War II, and the Germans have left, and most of the French have left, except for their sort of relic islands in the central South Pacific. So most Europeans have now left, and the Pacific Islanders are now being left to their own devices after having been colonized and they're, you know, irradiated and their people enslaved or at least subjected to all sorts of stringent labor conditions, or their oceans overfished or polluted. So we Westerners have not done very well by the Pacific Ocean, and now that the Pacific Ocean peoples have got back control of their ocean, perhaps things will go rather better.
You've been traveling recently in Australia and New Zealand and seeing some signs of hope in that regard, haven't you?
Well, yes, in all sorts of ways. I mean, one of the things that I'm actually writing about at the moment here in Massachusetts is the way that the Aboriginals in Australia and the Maoris in New Zealand, who had a particularly bad relationship, and hardly surprisingly, with the people, the Europeans that colonized those two countries, have since the 1970s and 80s enjoyed a rather better relationship. And one of the sort of small symbolic things that I'm noticing is that every time I stood up to give a speech, whether it was in Perth or Adelaide or Melbourne or Wellington, the person that organized it would give a 30-second peroration out of respect to the original owners of the land, whether it was a particular Aboriginal family or a particular Maori family. And that, to the local Aboriginals and the local Maoris, does give them some degree of sort of comfort. At last, you're acknowledging, they say, that you white people were not the original settlers here, that we were, and we've been here for thousands of years in the case of the Aboriginals. It's the sort of thing I'd like to see happen here in the United States, because, of course, the North American Indians, who are, of course, genetically a Pacific people as well, since they came over the land bridge, the Bering Strait land bridge, they have been accorded very little respect. And I'd sort of rather like to see this rather touching ceremony begin here in America. It probably never will, but it's something that I certainly found encouraging both in New Zealand and in Australia.
Simon Winchester is the author of Pacific, published by HarperCollins. His other books include Krakatoa, Atlantic, and The Professor and the Madman. We lost Hawaii Congressman Mark Takai to pancreatic cancer in July of 2016. Beth Ann spoke to him in February about the outlook for federal support of housing for veterans and about a long-range missile test by North Korea that was represented to the world as only a satellite launch.
This is a problem, a challenge for the entire world. And it's not only going to be the United States getting involved. It's going to be the whole world.
How would you see a whole world involvement take shape, given the fact that, you know, UN marginally effective at times, despite a lot of rhetoric, but when it really comes down to how do you stop some of those actual things from getting to North Korea, how do you stop them from actually being able to impact so many other countries when North Korea doesn't seem to really care that much what other people think, and also trying to do the best it can with what it has, and that means taking the stance that it has over years.
You know, what's interesting is about a year ago, I had a chance to travel to Asia as part of a CODEL, a congressional delegation headed by Leader Pelosi, and we had a chance to stop by it and talk to the president as well as other leaders in Myanmar, Burma. And we knew at that time that Burma was one of the nations that had a relationship, a close relationship with North Korea. And as the only person sitting on the defense committee of the delegation, I had a chance to talk to the president. Now, he's no longer there, you know, because Aung San Suu Kyi and her party has taken over, which is a good thing. But there are people, there are nations across the world that need to be talked to and challenged for their support of North Korea. And I think, you know, if we can restrict the access to funding and the technology, we'll make better headway in this particular situation. But, you know, one of the challenges when you deal with bad actors, and in this case, King Jong-un is, you know, for all practical purposes, not only a bad actor, but he's just kind of a loose cannon. You know, it's very difficult to deal with a leadership and a regime like that. But we got to do our best. And like I said before, it's a world problem. We've got to deal with it. Not only the United States sanctions and congressional action, but clearly the UN and Russia has to get involved, and some of the other world powers need to get involved as well.
Because we only have you for a limited time, mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the Housing Opportunity Through Modernization Act that you voted for earlier this mm-hmm. month. Among other provisions, especially regarding HUD veterans programs, the measure would make some changes in how low-income people and families could use vouchers to move to units that are in better neighborhoods, giving them some choice with all of that. We had some issues with landlords not wanting to accept veterans, let alone just other people. What makes you think that somehow a bill like this or a measure like this nationally is going to make landlords, and particularly landlords in Hawaii, look at accepting vouchers as being a solution to homelessness?
Well, let me take a step back. As you recall, in December, Congress passed the omnibus budget. And in that particular budget, there was considerable emphasis on the HUD programs, including those focused on the elderly, persons with disabilities, Section 8, public housing, and then veterans. In fact, we've overall increased the amount of funding to HUD to $38 billion, which is about a 10% increase from the prior year. So in terms of the funding for this fiscal year ending September 30th, 2016, we've seen a tremendous bump up in federal funds. And as a result of that, we're anticipating about a little less than 10% increase for the programs in Hawaii. That's a good thing because, we need to provide on the federal side enough federal support to focus and fund these programs. Now, the bill that we just passed was years in the making. In fact, initially we had heard that it might be a tough vote for the Democrats, although I'm very supportive of that bill. But at the end of the day, I think it was nearly unanimous. And it was an opportunity for us to catch up on some of the difficulties that we've had with HUD programs over the years across the nation. You know, it's my hope that we can continue the focus and support on federal funding.
Congressman Mark Takai was a 20-year member of the Hawaii State House of Representatives before his 2014 election to the United States Congress. He died in July of the past year. During his tenure in Congress, he served on the House Armed Services Committee and the House Committee on Small Business. The conversations you've heard this morning are some of our favorites from the year gone by. We'll return to live programming tomorrow with a look at the place of education in the state's 2017 budget and several other conversations. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkook, and we'll meet you back tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.